This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Rabbi Brant Rosen, one of the foremost anti-Zionist voices in the Jewish community in America, about what's going on in Israel and Palestine.
He comes to us the day after being arrested in Washington, D.C., along with many other members of Jewish Voice for Peace. Then we're joined by award-winning journalist Chris Hedges to learn why he is convinced that America is far down the road that ends at fascism.
This is a profound interview. I would call Chris Hedges our great moral philosopher.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Israeli warplanes are bombing the northern half of the Gaza Strip, reducing everything: hospitals, mosques, schools, homes, United Nations headquarters, to rubble. Those who survive the forced march south may be driven into the Sinai Desert. More than 1 million Palestinians have lived there. They've been ordered to vacate their homes and walk south on pain of death. Food, water, electricity, and medical supplies have been cut off to these people, half of whom are children. This is being facilitated by American military, financial, diplomatic, and media support. We speak today with Rabbi Brant Rosen. He is the leader of the Congregation Sadik Chicago, whose members are not Zionists and who oppose the historic Zionist project of dispossessing the native Palestinians, forcing them out of their homeland. The attention of the world today is focused on the tiny northern half of the Gaza Strip. Sadik Chicago's website states that during the course of his rabbinate, Rabbi Brant Rosen became an increasingly vocal activist for justice and human rights, particularly in Israel and Palestine. After publicly wrestling with his relationship with Israel and openly questioning his lifelong Zionism, he eventually became a prominent Jewish presence in the Palestine Solidarity Movement, co-founding the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council. Rabbi Brant's writings have appeared in many journals and publications, including Newsweek, the Chicago Tribune, the Jewish Forward, Tikkun, and Truthout. Tikkun magazine editor Rabbi Michael Lerner wrote that Rabbi Brant Rosen is, quote, at once a courageous rabbi and the voice of a new generation of American Jews who are refusing to allow the right-wing voice of the Jewish world to define Judaism. Rabbi Brant Rosen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Rabbi, can you please, as we start out, tell us what's going on in Gaza right now as we speak? And secondly, you were arrested in a demonstration in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Please talk about that.
Sure. Well, I think as far as what's going on in Gaza as we speak, I think most of the world knows the basic facts. On October 7th, Hamas staged a violent and brutal raid inside Israel and killed over, I believe it's 1,200 people, and abducted hostages. And in response, the Israeli military, directed by the Israeli government, has launched an overwhelming military assault on Gaza, on a small strip of land with 2 million people inside it. A few days ago, they told 1 million people in the north half of the strip to evacuate, presumably because they wanted to just decimate that area, which is the most populous part of the Gaza Strip. And so right now, over half of the country has been displaced, dispossessed from their homes. I believe the latest death count is over 3,000, I think it's 3,300 people, including, I think it's definitely over 1,000 children. There was a horrible attack, a military aerial attack on a hospital 2 days ago, in which hundreds of people who were unable to evacuate to the south were killed, including doctors and nurses and caregivers. The situation is just beyond comprehension. The current situation, we don't really know on the ground, because there's been a total blockade of electricity and water. And any information really getting in and out is relatively sporadic and mainstream media is not able to truly cover it. I'll just say that all of this is happening with the full support of the U.S. government. Biden just returned from Israel with a full-throated support of what Israel is doing, the Netanyahu administration is doing. And there seems to be no one who's willing to stand up and hold Israel to account or to attempt to, at least, the very least, broker any kind of ceasefire. So the carnage is continuing as we speak. The demonstration yesterday that you asked about was called by an organization that I'm involved with called Jewish Voice for Peace, a Jewish organization that stands in solidarity with Palestinians. We did it in conjunction with other groups, including a group called If Not Now. And it was a coordinated set of actions across Washington, D.C., of literally hundreds of Jews and allies. And the central action, which was one that I was involved in, took place in a congressional office building, the Cannon office building in the Rotunda, where over 300 of us sat and held the Rotunda, essentially unfurling banners for immediate ceasefire and to end the genocide in Gaza. There were about two dozen rabbis. I'm the co-chair of the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council, and the rabbis were the ones in the center of the action, leading prayer, song, chant, reading testimonials from Gazans. And in the end, over 300 people took a rest. So we were in D.C. all night long, and I just returned to Chicago this morning.
Rabbi Rosen, what is Zionism, and what was it that caused you to reject it?
Well, we could spend a lot of time talking about that question alone. I'll say the short answer to the question, what is Zionism, is I would say Zionism is a political Jewish nationalist movement that was established in the early 20th century with the goal of creating a Jewish majority state in historic Palestine, which, as we all know, resulted in the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. Because the goal was to create a Jewish majority state, that meant that the presence of non-Jews was problematic. And when the Zionist movement was initiated, Jews were a very, very distinct minority. There were Jews native to Palestine, but a very, very distinct minority. And so in order to create a Jewish majority, there needed to be a set of actions that were taken, and probably the most well-known took place in 1948, which Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, Zionists refer to as the War of Independence, in which 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their homes in villages and cities throughout Palestine and not allowed to return. Many of them were turned into refugees, and they are now the world's largest refugee population. And really the crux of Zionism, which is an ethno-nationalist movement, in other words, a nation that is predicated on the identity of one group of people and the maintenance of a majority of that people in the land, necessarily involved the dispossession of those who are not part of that group. And in a nutshell, that's why I, as a Jew, do not consider myself a Zionist. In fact, I consider myself an anti-Zionist because I believe the very premise of Zionism countenances and necessitates the oppression of another people.
So then you, having rejected Zionism, you went on to form a new congregation in Chicago. Tell us about that and the core principles of that congregation.
So we founded Tzedek Chicago in the spring of 2015. Prior to that, I served a congregation in Evanston, a Jewish Reconstructionist congregation, for 16 years. And as my own feelings and ideals about Israel and Palestine and Zionism evolved, it became clear that I was not able to stay in the congregation anymore, which had a membership that had a diversity of feelings and connections to Zionism and to Israel. So I left the congregation and took a job with the American Friends Service Committee. I worked as their Midwest Regional Director out of Chicago. And shortly after that, started a new congregation that we called Tzedek Chicago, which means Justice Chicago. And from the very outset, before we actually started to recruit members, we myself and the founders of the congregation drafted a list of core values that the congregation would be based on. And it's a wide-ranging list. It's not only about the issue of Zionism. It has to do with Judaism beyond borders, understanding that, you know, all peoples are of infinite worth, and that we see diversity as a strength, and we advocate for a world beyond borders, and don't believe that any one particular group of people is entitled to a specific part of the world than any other. We're based on values of solidarity, of nonviolence, but we also make a point of saying that we oppose Zionism. When we started, we referred to ourselves as non-Zionists. 2 years ago, our congregation took a vote and changed that to anti-Zionist, which I could talk about. But according to our core value, that means that we openly acknowledge that the creation of the ethnic Jewish nation state in historic Palestine has resulted in an injustice against the Palestinian people, an injustice that continues to this day. So that is an integral part of our collective vision statement. Now, I want to say that it's not a litmus test for membership. We don't insist that all of our members personally adhere to every single one of our values. We don't police people's beliefs. Our approach is really that these are our collective communal values. And if this is a community that you want to be a part of, even as you struggle with these issues personally, then we welcome members. And there are many members, I'm sure, for whom this is not their cup of tea, and that's all right, too. There are plenty of other congregations out there that they can join.
Rabbi Rosen, the Hamas attack on October 7, the taking of hostages, the murder of many civilians, was horrific and deserving of our condemnation. The mass media in the United States, however, has uniformly characterized the attack as unprovoked. Is it true that it was unprovoked?
So first of all, I would answer that by saying I agree with your characterization of the Hamas attack. It was brutal and tantamount to a war crime, and there's no condoning the murder and abduction of civilians. Like many Jews around the world, I have friends and loved ones in Israel, and I mourn these losses. At the same time, it is incorrect and patently unhelpful to refer to this as unprovoked, because such a statement just betrays an egregious lack of context to the situation. These kinds of things don't just spring out of the ground. The situation in Gaza goes back decades. As I was just saying when I was referring to the Nakba earlier in 1948, so we need, when we try to understand these kinds of incidents, to really understand them in context and not simply chart the beginning point with the latest incident. And you know, it's important to keep in mind that the people of Gaza, as I mentioned before, now over 2 million people being subjected to a brutal and crushing blockade by Israel. That began in 2007 after the election of Hamas. And by the way, Hamas was a democratically elected leader of Palestinians in Gaza. And so the Gaza Strip filled up with 200,000 refugees who lived in the surrounding areas in mostly southern Israel. And at the time, there was the full hope and indication that refugees would be allowed to return to their homes. In fact, there was a UN declaration demanding that, but that never happened. Israel never allowed the refugees to return. The refugees languished in Gaza, in some cases just mere kilometers away from where their homes and farms were. Some of them could actually see them through the barbed wire. Whenever they went through at the time, and this is well documented, to retrieve belongings from their homes or to harvest their fields, they were shot on sight because they were considered infiltrators. And that is the history of Gaza. Today, 70% or more of the population of Gaza are refugees. As I mentioned before, it contributes to the largest refugee population in the world. And this is a people who have been under oppression, under severe oppression for decades. And when people are oppressed, they tend to resist their oppression. And when that oppression is violent, which it almost is by definition always, their resistance can take the form of violence. And that is what has been happening, not only out of Gaza, also from other areas around Israel-Palestine, the West Bank, which also has refugee camps. And the fact that this crushing blockade and this crushing occupation has been allowed to continue with impunity, with no one holding Israel to account, means that periodically we're going to see these violent uprisings. That doesn't mean that we condone the murder of innocents, but it does mean we have to understand it. We have to understand the context of it, and we have to address it, because if we allow it to continue, you know, as what Israel considers to be just managing the conflict, you know, in quotes, that's only going to allow the trauma and the violence and the sense of denial to these people to be handed down to the next generation. Families in Gaza know where they come from. They know where their homes are, and they fully expect and desire to return. So that is really the context. That is the provocation. The provocation goes back as far as 1948. And if we don't understand that, we're only going to see these cycles of violence continue, and they're going to be more and more bloody, as we're seeing now.
Well, Rabbi Rosen, we know that a few days ago now, the Israeli government ordered all of the Palestinians living in the northern half of Gaza, over 1 million people, a half of whom are children. They ordered them to evacuate to the south, and that began to transpire, given all the difficulties, but nevertheless, the people complied, fearing for their lives. And then the Israeli government commenced heavily bombing, of course, in the north of Gaza. And already we've had many reports of massive casualties there, massive damage to Palestinian homes, their mosques, hospitals and schools, and the like. What is your judgment on this action that was taken by the Israeli government?
I think these actions are heinous. I think they're war crimes, and they're probably the most brutal that we've seen them conduct in Gaza. And we've seen some pretty brutal military assaults on Gaza going back to the beginning of the ascension of Hamas. You know, I would clarify that they have told the 1.1 million residents of northern Gaza, mostly in and around Gaza City, to go south, but they've bombed the roads to the south, so many of them are not able to go. They are also bombing the south. There are reports of massive bombing in Khan Yunis, which is in the south of Gaza. So there is no safe haven. There are also people in hospitals and elderly and infirm. In fact, I have one friend in Gaza who's sent his entire family to go south, but stayed behind with his grandmother because she's unable to move. We haven't heard from him in days. We don't know what has happened to him, but we fear the worst. So, you know, they've displaced over 1 million people, many of whom are not able to go south. And in the meantime, they are bombing through and through. Perhaps the heaviest bombing is in the north, but they have not ceased bombing in the south. I am comfortable using the word genocide. This is a trapped population with nowhere to run. And it's pretty clear when you listen to the rhetoric of Israel's politicians and military leaders referring to Palestinians as animals, vowing a second Nakba, that this kind of dehumanizing language is pretty offers a pretty clear view of what their intentions are. And that is just to wipe, not only to militarily defeat Hamas, but to wipe Gaza off the map once and for all.
Rabbi Rosen, our government has provided political, military, economic, and diplomatic support for Israel. The diplomatic corps has been instructed not to mention the word ceasefire. Biden went over there to show his support. Why is this the case, and what should we do about it?
You know, I can't answer fully the question of why is this the case, other than to say that I think every U.S. administration going back years has seen Israel as a quote-unquote strategic ally, as a strategic ally in that region. They are a massive recipient of arms. I think the sale of arms is a profitable business. Especially arms that are battle-tested on actual humans. I think there are all kinds of interests who see the continuation of war to be in their own personal interest, and as long as no one in the world with any real power is holding Israel to account, it's going to continue. No one seems to want to stop it. No government, no state. Plenty of human rights agencies and protesters in the streets, perhaps. But as long as the U.S., for its own strategic, you know, in quotes, designs and purposes, see Israel as a advantageous ally, it's going to give Israel carte blanche to do these things. That's about the best I can say. You'd have to ask a political analyst to say more than that. What we need to do, what can we do? Do more of what we saw yesterday in Washington, D.C. We need to take to the streets. We need to protest. We need to write to our senators. We need to demand and keep on the front page the large numbers of people who I truly know and believe that what Israel doing amounts to genocide and war crimes, and it needs to stop right away. Right now, we need a ceasefire. We absolutely need a ceasefire. And the fact that Biden went to Israel and gave a full-throated support of what Netanyahu and the state of Israel is doing was just deeply, deeply discouraging. It's not clear to me what kinds of diplomatic efforts, if any, are going on behind the scenes, but it certainly looks like Israel is right now, at the moment, being given carte blanche by the world community, by the international community, to commit the crimes that it's committing in Gaza.
Rabbi, my next question, as I confess in asking it, a very difficult question of anyone. We know that for, decades now, there have been efforts at reaching some kind of a quote-unquote just settlement of this now 75-year dispute, if you will, a violent dispute. And there have been certain efforts, certain progress has been made, only to see it reversed and so forth. What in your mind at this point, knowing what we now know and after all these decades, would constitute a just settlement of this decades-old war? And do you believe that such a solution is obtainable?
Actually, I think that's the easiest question you've asked me. I think a just solution, a just peace in Israel-Palestine would be that every single person who lives in that land between the river and the sea is given full citizenship, is given equal rights, full civil and human rights, regardless of what their identity is. That is a just solution. It's a kind of a state that ostensibly, at least, Americans believe in. That is democracy and equal rights for all who live in the land. It's still a struggle in this country as well, but at least we have a democracy that at least pays lip service to the notion of all people are created equal. The definition of people at the outset was a bit negligible, but at least we have that concept, and we purport to cherish that concept. Israel is a nation state that is predicated on the identity of one specific group of people. That's why I'm an anti-Zionist, right? Because I believe the very concept of an ethnically Jewish state is in and of itself an inequitable idea. So it's not enough to talk about reform. We need one democratic state between the river and the sea. That, to my mind, is not a radical idea, really, on the face of it, or at least it shouldn't be for centrist liberals, I would think. You know, how we get there, that is a question for down the line. I mean, right now, the first order of business is to end the bloodshed, is to end the occupation, is to hold Israel to account. I mean, even before this latest assault on Gaza was going on, Israel has been carrying on a brutal, brutal occupation and committing acts of violence every single day. This past year in particular, hundreds of Palestinians, it's been I think over 300 at this point, it's the highest in years. Israel is creating a regime of violence that subjects Palestinians to an atmosphere of violence every second of their lives. That needs to end before anything else happens. How we get there is we have to end the oppression, we have to end the abuse. And then once that happens, I think the international community can talk about how we get to the point of creating equity in the land. And how do we stop the stop the violence. It's what I've been saying before. We need to, those who believe in this vision need to fight for it. We need to demand that our representatives in Congress and the president, the presidential administrations that govern this country do not give unconditional support to everything Israel wants and says it needs. It needs to condition aid on behaving according to ethics of and laws of international law. I often like to put it this way. I'm as a rabbi, I'm a mandated reporter, like many people in caregiving professions. And that means if someone comes to me and tells me that they are committing abuse, I am mandated by law to report that person, because I now have knowledge that abuse is happening in real time. And unless I report it, I am party to that abuse. I think we all have to be mandated reporters when it comes to Israel, because we know what Israel is doing. Their oppressive actions through this occupation has been well documented by human rights organizations, including Israel's own human rights organization, B'Tselem, which declared Israel an apartheid regime and a regime of Jewish supremacy between the river and the sea. So we can't say that we don't know. We just need to have the courage of our convictions to demand that our leaders hold Israel to account.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Brant Rosen. Unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time. But before we have to say goodbye, can you tell our listeners how they can join in your work, follow your writings?
Sure. Thank you. I still write on my blog, which is rabbibrant.com, probably the easiest way to read my current and past writings. I welcome subscribers on the blog, as all bloggers do. My congregation, Tzedek Chicago, TZEDEK Chicago.org, that's our website, and you can find out more about us if what I've been talking about is interesting to anyone, and including our full text of our core values, and you can learn much more about who we are, what we do, and what we believe at our website.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi. It's been very heartening for Jim and I to be able to speak with you, and I'm sure we share that with our listeners. So we wish you every success in your work, and we say goodbye.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you reaching out to have me on your show.
Thanks, Rabbi. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Our guest today claims that we are far down the road that leads to fascism in the United States, and he places the blame at the feet of the liberal class, their failure to halt the corporate assault on working people that has spawned an ascendant Christian fascism that is poised to seize power and radically reshape America. As he says in an article of his of October 8th, the parting gift, I expect, of the bankrupt liberalism of the Democratic Party will be a Christianized fascist state. The liberal class, a creature of corporate power, captive to the war industry and the security state, unable or unwilling to ameliorate the prolonged economic security and misery of the working class, blinded by a self-righteous woke ideology that reeks of hypocrisy and disingenuousness and bereft of any political vision, is the bedrock on which the Christian fascists, who have coalesced in cult-like mobs around Donald Trump, have built their terrifying movement, close quote. Well, our guest, of course, is the award-winning journalist and political writer, Chris Hedges. Chris Hedges reported for the New York Times from 1990 to 2005 and served as the Times Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief during the years in the former Yugoslavia was at war. In 2001, Hedges was one of the Times writers on an entry that received the 2002 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory writing. Prior to his work for the Times, he worked as a freelance war correspondent in Central America for the Christian Science Monitor, National Public Radio, and the Dallas Morning News. Chris Hedges' books include Death of the Liberal Class, War on America, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, as well as his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. Well, Chris Hedges, a very warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you.
You know, Chris, in an article of yours of October 8th, you blame what you call bankrupt liberalism for what you see as a fast-approaching fascism here in the United States. Tell us in what ways you believe that liberalism has become bankrupt, and then how its bankruptcy has, well, empowered those you label the Christian fascists.
These are the themes of two of my books, Death of the Liberal Class and American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. And I want to preface that by saying that I come out of a religious tradition. My father was a Presbyterian minister. I graduated from Harvard Divinity School. So this is not an attack like the new atheists on religion or Christianity. But having spent 2 years with the Christian right, I saw it as a political movement, heretical in terms of inverting the values of the Christian gospel to serve the interests of imperialism and capitalism. Jesus did not come to make us rich. Jesus did not bless the dropping of iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East. These pastors in these mega churches have a cult-like following. They're, of course, very wealthy. They prey on the despair of their congregants who have been thrust aside by austerity and deindustrialization. And so I always saw it as a kind of proto-fascist movement. It didn't really come to power or achieve some semblance of power until the Trump presidency. And Trump, who has no real ideology, filled his ideological void with the Christian right, figures like Barr and Pence and others who he promoted, and then, of course, lower levels within his administration. As far as the liberal class, so the liberal class, and Chomsky has probably given us the best definition of what the liberal class is in a capitalist democracy. It works to ameliorate the excesses of the system. A perfect example would be FDR's New Deal. So there you have the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s, and the ruling class embodied in Roosevelt responds to tremendous suffering, unemployment, and economic deprivation by instituting government programs, Social Security, work programs, as a federal works project. There had been a ban or many major unions after the agitation, socialization in particular, the 1920s had been banned. Roosevelt lifted those bans. And in private correspondence, actually with his brother, which I've read, Roosevelt says we have to begin to address this suffering, this economic dislocation, or we will get revolution. That's Roosevelt's word. And that's how the liberal class functions. So the liberal class ameliorates the worst excesses or most egregious injustices visited in a capitalist democracy. At the same time, it posits itself as the moral arbiter of society. And it's used as a kind of attack dog against radicals and the left. The perfect example, in my own case, would be, and I had been the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, 7 years in the Middle East, an Arabic speaker, and I denounced the calls on the part of the Bush administration to invade Iraq. So those who essentially were used to discredit me came from the quote-unquote liberal establishment, Michael Ignatieff, George Packer and others, the New Yorker, David Remnick, and everyone else, because they abrogate to themselves this kind of moral authority. They're very effective in the service of the ruling class. As Noam Chomsky points out, what you're not allowed to do within the liberal establishment is question the virtues or motives of the ruling elite. If you do that, then you are pushed out, as Chomsky has been, virtually. So that's how the liberal class is allowed to function. It will run the universities. It has a prominent role within the press. But it knows those boundaries, and it doesn't cross them. With the rise of corporate capitalism, what John Ralston Saul calls our corporate coup d'etat in slow motion, which really began in the 1970s, the Lewis Powell memo, 1971, essentially the blueprint by which corporate power would push back against the popular movements that arose in the 1960s, you saw corporations organized to seize control of what had previously been democratic or open spaces, open institutions, universities, the press, the Democratic Party, Bill Clinton, and then he, of course, is aided by this California Congressman Tony Coelho. They realize that if they do corporate bidding, they will get corporate money. And that's precisely what happened, the transformation of the Democratic Party. Labor used to have a voice within the Democratic Party, and I don't want to romanticize the Democratic Party. It wasn't like the old Labor Party in Britain, but at least there was a concern or an understanding that a significant part of their constituency came out of labor. Clinton, of course, betraying labor with NAFTA, which was the worst betrayal of the working class since perhaps the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act that makes it very difficult to organize, you saw a transformation of the liberal class. The liberal class no longer existed in order to ameliorate the situation, but essentially became captive to corporate power. And so it redefined itself through what we call woke politics. And that is the kind of cultural issues, the tangential issues, whereas on all of the major economic issues and the issues of war, there was complete agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats. And the liberal class was essentially destroyed. So there's no check anymore on the excesses of corporate power. We've undergone this kind of slow motion corporate coup d'etat. And what we've seen is the rise of what Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, by which he means we still have the facade, we still have the structures and the iconography and language of American democracy, but internally corporations have seized all of the levers of power.
Chris Hedges, in your article you quote Benjamin Carter Hett, who in the introduction to his book, The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic, he writes how what is happening in the United States today more clearly resembles the 1930s than it does the 1990s. In what ways is this true? And what does it portend for how and when fascism will arrive in America?
So Hecht makes an interesting point, which I hadn't thought of until I read his book, which is called The Death of Democracy, Hitler's Rise to Power and the Downfall of the Weimar Republic. He said that a major reaction or a major impetus for the rise of fascism was globalization and the control of the German economy by the international banking system. And I think that's true because we have all lost control over our economies. No country in the industrialized world anymore controls its economy. And when a country like Greece attempts to control its economy, its economy is destroyed. And you had this very sad example of Syriza, a left-wing government that rose or took power to essentially deal with the terrible austerity programs that were imposed on Greece, and the EU and the banking system essentially shut off the fund. I mean, they strangled the country to death, and you ended up having Syriza administer essentially on behalf of the international banks. So I think that that parallel is correct, and there is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs or Citibank or ExxonMobil or any of these other large corporations. They populate the or their major leaders, CEOs and administrators populate, no matter which administration, including Trump, they populate the government. So I think that that is, and when we no longer control our economy, then our voices, our suffering, our dislocation, none of it, all of it doesn't matter. I mean, you had Yellen, publicly saying that unemployment was good to bring down inflation. That's a perfect example. So it's all about maintenance of the economy on behalf of the elite rather than maintenance of the economy on behalf of the citizenry.
Chris, you also quoted your October 8th article that Robert Paxton, in his book, The Anatomy of Fascism, writes, and I quote, "The language and symbols of authentic American fascism would have little to do with the original European models. They would have to be as familiar and reassuring to loyal Americans as the language and symbols of the original fascism were familiar and reassuring to many Italians and Germans." So, Chris, are we already seeing any evidence that this is taking place here in America?
Well, yes. Just look at the Congress. Look at the kind of cult-like following around Trump you have within the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, we should be clear, is not the old Republican Party. The establishment figures within the Republican Party have now grafted themselves onto the Democratic Party, Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, etc. And that's because, of course, again, as I said earlier, there is no real difference on the major trade agreements, war, wholesale surveillance, anything else between the two parties, and surrendered the Republican Party to Trump and his followers. And these are people who are actively subverting Democratic controls, defending the incursion into the Capitol on January 6th. So I think if Trump is reelected, and unfortunately, I think the weakness of the Biden administration makes that possible, if Trump is reelected, he will come back. I mean, there are three iterations to Trump. Jeff Charlotte does a good job of delineating this in his book, Undertow. The first is the huckster. I'm rich, you can be rich. The second is the conspiracy theorist, QAnon, etc. And the third is really a full-blown Christian fascism. So if he comes back into power, it will be very different from the other Trump administration. It will be solely about vengeance and about destroying what's left of our very anemic democracy to serve personal interests on the part of Trump, who, of course, will get fabulously rich, he and his coterie, but also the destruction of what's left of any kind of popular resistance or popular movements. I think at that point we can really argue that what's left of American democracy will be extinguished.
This is Michael Smith. I'm here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Chris Hedges on American fascism. Chris, Fritz Stern, a refugee from Hitler's Germany and a leading scholar of German fascism, warned in 2005 of those similarities between the mood in Germany as fascism arose there and now here in the United States. And he described the common factors between Germany then and America now, and identified some factors that, as he put it, quote, fertilized fascist movements. What were those factors that he felt were growing in America today?
Well, economic dislocation. I mean, all of the great writers on fascism point to despair. Stern did. I mean, his book is called The Politics of Cultural Despair. Hannah Arendt also triggered despair of as essentially the trigger by which people were pushed into a totalitarian belief system. And one of the one of the most important points of any totalitarian system, including the Christian right, is that it embraces magical thinking. So the reality-based world is so threatening and has delivered so much personal and economic damage that you essentially walk away from it. And then on the fundamental factor in the rise of any fascism is a bankrupt liberalism, which we've just explained. And this was certainly true in late Weimar in Germany, where you had a bankrupt liberalism, people who were determined to recreate the Ancien Regime, which no one wanted. They were rightly feared the rise of fascism and the Nazi Party, but that ruling elite couldn't carry out the kind of social reforms that could divert the attraction of the fascist party.
Chris, you've written of an interview you had with the famed U.S. left political thinker and professor, activist, of course, Noam Chomsky, back in 2010. And you point out that he saw we were on a road ending at fascism. You write that he said, and I quote, "It is very similar to late Weimar Germany. The parallels are striking. The most striking fact about Weimar was not that the Nazis managed to destroy the Social Democrats and the Communists, but that the traditional parties, the conservative and liberal parties, were hated and eventually disappeared," close quote. This calls to mind, of course, the very small, I don't know, maybe 15% or so of Americans who have any positive views left of the U.S. Congress. And you note that Jeff Charlotte makes the same point about the Americanized face of fascism in his book, The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. So talk to us about this and what it portends for America down the road.
Well, I think in many ways the Biden administration was the last chance. I was not very hopeful because, again, it is bound completely to its the oligarchy and corporate donors. It serves their interests along with the war industry. We're seeing that now, both the vetoing of a ceasefire, calling for a ceasefire, the vetoing of this proposal at the UN by the Biden administration, which is utter insanity. The inability on the part of the Democratic Party, which is in power, to address the very real suffering and dislocation means that done nothing, in essence, to make inroads into that roughly 60% of the population that is living very precariously because of substandard minimum wage, because of corporate predatory behavior through our for-profit healthcare system, or the privatization of utilities, or student debt, or personal debt, or credit card debt, etc. It's a debt peonage as a form of social control, as any African American knows. So that failure on the part to address the root causes of social malaise means that it's extremely likely, and history is probably a pretty good guide, that the alternative for those people whose situation has not been in any way changed under the Biden administration will be something radical like the Trump administration. We also have to factor in that the largest, I mean, you know, I've worked with the Green Party and was Ralph Nader's speechwriter, and we're always attacked. Third-party movements are always attacked. But I think the Green Party in the last presidential election pulled 0.26% of the vote, not even a third of 1%. The real problem are the 80 million eligible voters who don't vote. It's apathy. And they don't vote because they don't think it's much is going to change in their life, no matter who's in power. And frankly, they're probably right. So it's that apathy, you know, the apathy, it's that online, or the Yeats line, the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. That's what always happens with the rise of a fascist movement, which never has a majoritarian support. I mean, even I think Hitler, the highest vote count they ever got was about 34%. So all of the elements are there, unfortunately, to snuff out American democracy.
By the year 2006, after you'd spent 2 years of reporting across America for your book entitled American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, you had been convinced that Christian nationalism was fascist and an existential threat to our democracy. That was in 2006, 2023 now. Has your mind changed in any way? Do you feel that threat is more so, less so? How would you sum it up?
You know, I ended that book. Well, the book begins with despair, and it ends because these people have retreated into an irrational world. You can't argue people out of the folly of creationism, the theories that go along with it. The conclusion of that book, and that's after 2 years of reporting all over the country, was that either we reintegrated these people back into the economy, and that means a sustainable wage, economic stability, a place within the society, work with dignity, protection, job safety, the right to unionize. We re-empower these people, in essence, within the society, or we're finished. And in fact, it's far worse than when I finished that book, and therefore, far more dire.
Before we do let you go, how can our listeners keep up with your writing? There's a great deal of it. Let our listeners know where they can keep up with you.
ChrisHedges.substack.com. That everything. I have a TV show out of Baltimore on the Real News, but all of my articles, all of the broadcasts are put out by ChrisHedges.substack.com.
It's just terrific. And I urge our listeners to grab as many of those writings and read as many of them as you can and listen to them whenever you have the chance, as we have today. And Chris Hedges, we certainly thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.